help you in that area. We're going to be talking with Dr. Kate Rayam Blue. In the second half of the show, we're going to be talking with Gary Kibsey, and we're going to be talking about herbalism and what happens in a health food store. But before we do that, here's Alan with the health news.
New research offers a compelling reason for parents to ban smartphones, tablets, and laptops in their children's bedrooms at night. The bright light of these devices may lower levels of melatonin, a hormone that prompts sleep. The effect was most pronounced for kids just entering puberty, with nighttime melatonin levels suppressed by up to 37% in some cases, the investigators found. Puberty and changing sleep habits go hand in hand, the study authors noted, as growing kids start to push for later bedtimes. To some degree, the shift is likely prompted by several social factors, including the loosening of parental restrictions, budding friendships, and media. But scientists believe that biological factors also play a role as a child's internal sleep clock starts to change. Can acupuncture benefit people with mildly or moderately elevated blood pressure? Perhaps, a small study suggests, but the researchers behind the trial acknowledge that it's too soon to say for sure. The researchers found that blood pressure levels declined slightly in a small group of patients treated 30 minutes a week with electroacupuncture, where the needles carry low-level electrical stimulation at specific points of the body. Potentially, blood pressure can be kept low with a monthly follow-up treatment, said study co-author Dr. John Longhurst, a cardiologist at the University of California, Irvine. Blood pressure can often be lowered by becoming more fit, taking medication, or both. But these approaches don't work for everyone, and medication can cause side effects, especially among the elderly. Avoiding middle-age spread could be one way to delay the onset of dementia, a new study hints. Researchers found that among 142 elderly adults with Alzheimer's disease, those who were overweight at age 50 tended to develop the memory-robbing disorder earlier. On average, the study participants were 83 years old when diagnosed with Alzheimer's, but that age of onset varied according to people's weight at age 50. For each unit increase in body mass index, Alzheimer's set in about 7 months earlier on average. Other studies have found that obesity may boost the risk of developing Alzheimer's, but this research suggests it also speeds the onset, said senior researcher Dr. Madhav Thambisetty of the U.S. National Institute on Aging. The study, published online September 1st in the journal Molecular Psychiatry, does not prove that obesity itself hastens Alzheimer's. Taking a midday nap might be beneficial for your heart, new research suggests. The investigators looked at how an hour-long siesta at noon affected blood pressure among nearly 400 middle-aged people with high blood pressure. The result? Those who napped saw their systolic blood pressure reading, the number on top of the standard blood pressure ratio, drop an average of 5% over the course of the day compared with patients who didn't rest. More specifically, the team found that nappers saw their blood pressure readings fall by 4% during the day and by 6% while sleeping at night. Study author Dr. Manolis Calistrato, a cardiologist at Asklepion Vula General Hospital in Athens, and his colleagues presented their findings recently at a meeting of the European Society of Cardiology in London. Research presented at medical meetings is considered preliminary until published in a peer-reviewed journal.
Thanks for that, Alan. Well, our first guest, Dr. Kate Rayam Blue, is a naturopathic physician and one of the authors of a number of books that are related to stress. And Dr. Kate is on the line with us today. Dr. Kate, welcome.
Thanks, Dave. Good to be back.
So, you know, this time of year, and I guess, you know, across Canada, the anxiety has been, you know, something that's been increasing. And you know, when we look at the studies, when we look at the research, it's showing that the number of people with anxiety has increased over the years. What are some of the factors that contribute to that?
Well, it's hard to say, but you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, the stats do suggest that rates of anxiety are increasing. More people and across every age spectrum, it seems, even from kids to, you know, teens, adults, seniors, are reporting greater levels of stress, feeling stressed more frequently at home, at school, at work. And, you know, what's underlying that, it's hard to say. The speed of life seems to just be picking up for all of us. And, you know, greater expectations of productivity or getting more done in less time and less time to unwind, but it all seems to be kind of coming together for increased stress, which sometimes manifests as anxiety for some people.
As a naturopathic physician, what do you suggest to people in terms of changes to their lifestyle that can really make a significant difference?
Well, this is the good news, is that there is actually a lot of evidence to suggest that both lifestyle changes as well as cognitive behavioral, so changes about the way we think, for example, about stress, and other natural approaches can be very effective at reducing stress. So, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that stress and its effects on us are something that, that we can change and our perception of it. And, you know, certain common, you know, basic common sense things like getting adequate sleep, you know, getting to sleep at the same time every night and waking up at the same time every morning, if possible, as well as regular exercise, not skipping meals, eating healthy food. These are common sense things, but they actually do make a difference in terms of our lifestyle and minimizing stress, which can lead to anxiety.
Hmm. In terms of sleep, how much sleep, you know, should we be getting?
Well, the 6 to 8 hours that's quoted, more around the 8 hour number, does seem to be an appropriate average. There are certainly disadvantages to getting less sleep than that, and even to getting a lot more sleep than that, sleeping too much. But I think just as important as the number of hours we may be in bed is sleep quality. And so making sure that you're feeling rested, that you're not waking up multiple times throughout the night, and that, again, you feel, you know, refreshed in the morning is key to evaluating your sleep.
What are some of the factors that can contribute to having, you know, you mentioned waking up in the night, you mentioned having not really good deep sleep. What are some of the things that really come into play there, and what effect does that have on anxiety?
Well, interestingly, nutrition can make a big impact on our sleep. So one under-recognized factor in the quality of our sleep is, surprisingly, fluctuations in our blood sugar while we're sleeping. So, for example, when people are eating highly processed foods throughout the day, and they may be on the blood sugar roller coaster, it's up and down throughout the day, and this is often characterized by changes in mood or energy, you know, that 3 p.m. slump in your energy or cravings for sweets and starchy foods, this can actually affect your blood sugar throughout the night, and this can actually cause you to wake up either at 3 o'clock in the morning or even multiple awakenings throughout the night. This can be a factor. But even just stress itself can elevate the levels of our stress hormones, which kind of oppose the relaxation effect that we really need for good quality sleep.
And so if we are waking up, you know, like 2 or 3 in the morning, are there things that we can do about that?
Yes, definitely. Well, as I was saying before, if waking up at 3 in the morning in particular is a concern, then you want to take a closer look at your blood sugar and that you are, surprisingly, starting the day. It's what you eat at the beginning of the day at breakfast that can make an impact on your blood sugar for the rest of the day. So avoiding the highly processed white foods, you know, the donuts and bagels in the morning, and instead look for slower release carbohydrates, some more complex carbohydrates, that old-fashioned oatmeal, but balance that out with some protein and some fat. And that helps keep blood sugar stable throughout the day, which helps you sleep better at night.
Mm. Yeah, you mentioned food as, you know, something that can make a difference in terms of anxiety. What is the relationship between nutrition, nutritional deficiencies perhaps, and anxiety and stress?
Oh, well, there are a number of nutritional deficiencies that can exacerbate anxiety. Deficiencies of the B vitamins, especially B12, can have effect on our neurological and cognitive functioning. Deficiencies of omega-3 essential fatty acids, a very important one for brain health and making sure we've got levels of those essential fats so our brain is functioning optimally, as well as, you know, the obvious things like, you know, not too much caffeine, which of course can make people feel anxious. And it's surprising how that easily can be overlooked.
Are we not getting the B vitamins in our diet that we used to, or is it just that the load of stress is causing this need for increased B vitamins?
You know what? It's both. So our adrenal glands are major organs of stress response, And they need certain nutrients to do their job properly. B vitamins are one of them, especially B5, but all the B vitamins really play a role. Magnesium is critical to the function of our adrenal glands, as well as zinc and vitamin C. And so when we're under stress, we have a greater demand for these nutrients because our adrenal glands are working harder. But then on the flip side of that, you know, studies suggest that levels of certain nutrients like B vitamins, like magnesium, is declining in our diet. And so, as we were saying before, life seems to be getting more stressful, which is causing an increased demand for these nutrients, and the nutrients may not be there in the amounts that they used to. So it's a bit of a double whammy.
What about herbs? You know, people have been using herbs for a long, long time in terms of reducing anxiety. What are some of the herbs that you really like?
Oh, well, herbs are really, you know, Mother Nature's way of helping us deal with stress and anxiety and giving us a little bit of a helping hand here. And there's a number that I really like that people are familiar with of herbs, like calming herbs like St. John's wort and other, you know, individual nutrients that you can find, like L-theanine from green tea. These are naturally calming herbs or naturally derived ingredients. But there's one that has recently come back to the market in Canada that I'm very excited about personally because I took a lot of this as a student, and that's Kava Kava. And this, because it's been off the market for a while, it's one that people might not be familiar with. Kava Kava is the common name for the herb Piper Mephisticum. And this is a herb that has a long history of traditional use in the South Pacific. South Pacific Islanders would use this for medicinal and ceremonial uses. Traditionally, mashed roots of the kava plant are consumed as a drink at religious, cultural, and social gatherings to promote relaxation. And people drinking kava often report more restful sleep afterwards, and studies confirm that the benefits of kava are profound for relief of occasional anxiety, insomnia, and restlessness.
So anxiety, insomnia, restlessness, you know, in terms of kava, what were the reasons why it was taken off the market before? Like, should be people be cautious with this?
That's a good, really good question. So the history here is that in early 2000, I think it was 2001, in fact, there were concerns raised about the safety of kava based on a couple of reports of a very small number of cases of reported toxicity with people who had taken kava. And this led to restrictions of the sale of kava in a number of countries, including Canada. However, after, you know, quite extensive studies were done, it was really found that the concerns around toxicity were rare. Most of the cases had other, likely other causes of toxicity, and really ended up being about maybe three cases where they weren't able to identify other sources of toxicity other than the kava. So despite the, you know, past history of links to kava and liver toxicity, really only a fraction of the cases reviewed could be linked with any certainty to the kava. So, you know, the estimates are about one in maybe 60 to 125 million patients may actually have experienced problems with kava. And so for this reason, kava has actually been deemed to be very safe, and it was returned to the market in Canada and Europe and throughout the world. And so people really don't have to be concerned about that.
So if I'm taking kava, what am I going to notice? Am I going to notice, is it like a multivitamin where I'm not going to notice anything for a long period of time or even...